chance to hear Hugh. Our first speaker this morning is Hugh Price from the University of Sydney. Hugh has been the advocate of the PR collaboration, which of which this workshop is one particular activity. He's done all the legwork and all the work in getting documents to various universities and budgets and all the rest of it, so we're all extremely grateful for the effort he has put in on the Australian side. Now, the title of his talk this morning is Toy Models for Retrocausality, so I'll hand it over to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared. And apologies to Jared and some of the other Australians present who've heard this talk already. I actually wrote it up first for a meeting at Griffith in November last year, which was a meeting in honour of David Pegg on the occasion of his retirement.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Okay, so as I was saying, apologies to Jared and some of the people from Australia who've heard this talk before. I wrote it up in this form originally for a meeting at Griffith last year in honour of David Pegg on the occasion of his retirement. But it's actually based on some ideas that I had on my way home after coming here for the first time this time last year. I went home via Europe, and the main part of the talk is based on some things I was thinking about on the plane as I left. More on that when we come to it. First, a little bit of history. I want to start with a quiz, and I'd like people who've seen this talk before to be quiet at this point, because obviously you know the answer. But the quiz is, who's that? Any? Pardon? Yes, but which one? That doesn't narrow it down very much. Okay, I'm going to give you a quote from this person and see if anyone gets it then. Any takers? No? Pardon? Yes. I thought that you might get it, Mike. Okay, so yes, this is Hugo Tetrode. I always think of it as Tetrode, which I think of as a wonderful name for a 20th century physicist. But the pun isn't quite so good in Dutch, I guess. Okay, so Tetrode was a Dutchman who studied in Leipzig around about 1910, 1912, and seems to have been something of a prodigy. He published his first paper, I think, when he was 17. And then after that, sort of worked as a private scholar. I think his health wasn't very good. And there was some family money, so he didn't really have to worry about getting a job. So he just sort of worked by himself in Amsterdam for the remaining 20 or so years of his life, and published three or four papers, of which this comes from a paper in 1922. And the interesting thing about it is that the idea he's expressing is that in order to understand electromagnetic radiation, we have to take the influence of the future into account, because, as he puts it, the sun wouldn't radiate if it weren't for the fact that there's a future absorber to absorb the photons that it's radiating. One of the people who knew about this idea and knew this paper was Einstein. And there's a story that Einstein and Ehrenfest went along to try and visit Tetrode at his house in Amsterdam, but were turned away by the maid, who said that Mr. Tetrode doesn't receive visitors. Anyway, about 20 years after that, at a seminar in Princeton, at which Wheeler and Feynman were presenting some of the ideas which went into their famous absorber theory of radiation, Einstein pointed out to them that there were connections with the work that Tetrode had done 20 years before. And in the published version of their paper, which is this one from 1945, they mention this connection and quote much the same passage as I just gave you from Tetrode's paper. So this is My interest in putting this into the history here is that this is one of the famous places in physics where the idea that in order to understand what's going on at a particular time, we have to think about the future as well as about the past plays a crucial role. And the other thing I wanted to call your attention to is this little quote from Bohr that they have at the top of the paper here. It says, "We must therefore be prepared to find that further advance into this region, that is quantum mechanics, will require a still more extensive renunciation of features which we're accustomed to demand of the space-time mode of description." And that's a quote from a paper of Bohr's in 1934. This paper of Wheeler refinements actually appears in an issue of Reviews of Modern Physics, which is a 60th birthday tribute to Bohr. So it was entirely appropriate for that reason, too, that they should be quoting Bohr at this point. But I wanted to call attention to it because I think there's a kind of nice kind of irony here, because if I'm right about the ideas that I'm going to be talking about later in the talk, then there's a sense in which, as it were, Bohr's view of quantum mechanics is a view you come to if you don't go far enough down this path that he's recommending, and that in a sense Wheeler and Feynman were recommending too here, although in the context of electromagnetism, the path of, as it were, taking a more symmetric view of the influence of the past and the future. Okay, this is one of the sort of upshots of the Wheeler-Feynman absorber theory. Was a prediction that if the future universe wasn't a perfect absorber, one ought to be able to detect that by detecting variations in the rate at which something like a microwave transmitter would transmit in different directions in space. Some people set out to test that prediction. Among them, and one of the people who contributed to the discussion on this point was David Pegg, who, as I mentioned, was the person in whose honor the meeting for which I wrote this talk was held. But what I'm interested in here is the application of these sorts of ideas about taking the future seriously in the case of quantum mechanics, not in the case of electromagnetism. And in the case of quantum mechanics, the biggest motivation for doing so comes from the kind of what we now think of as EPR Bell context. And so here's a diagrammatic representation of a typical Bell experiment or EPR experiment. It's a sort of diagram that I've stolen from one based on the ones you find in David Merman's work, I think. And I wanted to give you a quote from Bell to remind you of, as it were, what Bell's intuitions were about the EPR situation. Bell says, the observed perfect quantum correlations seem to demand something like the genetic hypothesis. For me, it's so reasonable to assume that the photons in those experiments carry with them programs telling them how to behave. This is so rational that I think when Einstein saw that and the others refused to see it, he was the rational man. The other people, although history has justified them, were burying their heads in the sand. I feel that Einstein's intellectual superiority over Bohr in this instance was enormous, a vast gulf between the man who saw clearly what was needed and the obscurantist. So for me, it's a pity that Einstein's idea doesn't work. The reasonable thing just doesn't work. So this is well known that Bell's intuitions were very much on the side of Einstein in this debate, even though he's often taken to have shown, in a sense, presumably to his own disappointment that Einstein was wrong. But the interest of these sorts of retrocausal ideas is that they, if they work, they would provide a sense in which Einstein was right after all, at least in the sense that he was right about quantum mechanics being incomplete and there being a sort of underlying level which explains what's going on in these kinds of cases. Okay, but the first person, I think, to sort of appreciate the potential of retrocausality in this context was this man. Does anyone know who that is? Yeah, so this is Costa de Beauregard. who was, in the late 40s, he was a student of de Broglie's in Paris. And it was at that time that he had this idea. And as he says here, in 1947, I proposed an explanation that was not to the liking of Louis de Broglie. I said to him, it's well known that all phenomena of fundamental physics are symmetrical between past and future at the elementary level. This is certainly a basic phenomenon. And between two distinct events in an EPR experiment, there's no direct link, but there is a direct link with the past or via the past. Therefore, I'm fully entitled to suggest that the influence spreads via a zigzag, first to the past and then into the future. Right, so that's Costa de Beauregard, who died a couple of years ago. Died just last year. But about 3 years ago, when I was visiting my now colleague, Guido Bacigalupi, who many of you will know in Paris, we went out and we made contact with Costa de Beauregard. And, he invited us out to lunch at his home outside Paris. And so here he is with one of his fans. Okay, so I think of Costa de Beauregard as the first person to have this idea that retrocausality might have something to do with what's going on in EPR cases in quantum mechanics. And so the basic idea is something like this. So the idea is something like the choice of a measurement setting, say, on the right in this diagram, can have an influence on the measurement outcome on the left via a causal path which goes via the source event in the past. And so you get this kind of zigzag causality. Of course, if it's going to work, it's going to have to be symmetric. So you also have an influence going in the other way as well, from the measurement setting on the left to the measurement outcome on the right. Okay, but it's not entirely clear that Costa de Beauregard was the first person to suggest retrocausality in the context of quantum mechanics. In fact, it's pretty clear that he wasn't. The first person to suggest retrocausality in quantum mechanics was this person, Greta Hermann, who was, originally a mathematician. She was a student of Noether's, who then, in the mid-30s, went to work for a while with Heisenberg's group in Leipzig. And it was at that point that she wrote a paper in which one of the ideas is something like the idea that quantum mechanics involves retrocausality. I should say that there's an apology due at this point to Michael Seefrink, whose slide this is. I stole it without acknowledgement from a talk that I found on his website. And so one of the reasons I've been delighted to discover that he's here is that I can find out some more about Greta Hermann directly from him. Okay, but one of the reasons I've mentioned her here, apart from the desire to give her credit as the first retrocausalist in quantum mechanics, is to just raise the issue as to whether her reason for introducing retrocausality had anything to do with what we now think of as non-locality and EPR issues. And there's a view around that you sometimes come across these days that it does. And here's an example of this. So this is an earlier photograph I found of Greta Hermann. I think this must be from the 1930s. So here's a quote that I found from a paper on the archive by W. Wharton. This isn't Ken Wharton, who's here with us. Ken, I'm not sure where Ken is. I can't see Ken. Ken is Wharton the younger, and this is Wharton the elder. This is actually Ken's father, I understand. And he says in this paper, the idea of using backward causation to explain the non-locality of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox has been around since the year the EPR paper was published. The idea that future events have a causal effect on past events was introduced by Greta Herman in 1935. That's certainly true, although, as I want to say, I think it's misleading to say that it was in the context of a discussion of EPR, although it was in the same year. And then it was, Wharton goes on to say, it was further explored by Costa de Beauregard in 1953 and later, but has been commonly ignored by almost everyone, including books devoted to the EPR paradox. Oh, and then here's something else I found on someone's blog or something like that, which has, again, got this idea that the kind of retrocausality that Greta Herman was interested in is linked to that of Costa de Beauregard and other people. He's got a list, including both me and David Pegg, of people who've been interested in it later. Although I don't know a great deal about Greta Herman, and I want to find out more, I think the truth is that her reason for introducing retrocausality was that she wanted to defend what she saw as a sort of Kantian principle of causality in the face of quantum mechanics. And so it was a way of resisting the idea that in quantum mechanics things happen without causes. And her idea was you can do that by saying they do have causes, but not all of the causes are in the past. Some of them in the future as well. So you get a kind of Kantian idea that nothing happens without a cause by putting some of the causes in the future. I think the motivation is something like that. And I think there are interesting connections to be explored with some of the things which go on within the time-symmetric approach to quantum mechanics, and especially some of the things done under the sort of two-time boundary condition approaches that people like Lev. But that'll have to be a discussion for another time. Okay, so I think it's fair to say that Costa de Beauregard is still the first of the people we might call the EPR retrocausalists. There aren't a lot more. Here's a list of some of the people. Well, I've included Herman here because she was in some sense a retrocausalist. And then all the other people on the list are people who are attracted to retrocausality because of its apparent application in the EPR case, although more in some cases than in others. I'm not sure to what extent that's true of Larry Shulman, for example. And of course, there are other people I could put on the list. And then there are people who about whom I feel unsure as to whether they should be on the list, including Lev and Aronoff and so on. But I wasn't making any attempt to be complete here. But they're very much a minority, and everybody else, I think, falls into a camp which you could either characterize as no, they certainly don't want to have anything to do with retrocausality, or don't know, they haven't even thought about the question. So I think most people are in that camp. And here's a recent example, and this is from a very clear and rather careful survey paper of sort of Einstein EPR kinds of issues in the light of Bell's results, published 3 years ago in the Einstein centenary year. And the author of this paper says, this is just in a footnote after a discussion of non-locality, he says, to be scrupulous, there are perhaps four other ways other than non-locality that the correlations in an EPR Bohm experiment could be explained away. One could simply refuse to consider the correlations mysterious. I think, strictly speaking, that's not explaining them away, it's just refusing to accept that there's any need for an explanation. Secondly, one could deny that the experimenters have free will to choose the settings of their measurement devices at random, as required for a statistically valid Bell experiment. Thirdly, one could entertain the idea of backward in time causation. And the author says, I do not consider these escape routes because they seem to undercut the core assumptions necessary to undertake scientific experiments. And that, as I said, is Howard Wiseman. Now, as I said, I think this is... One of the motivations for what I'm trying to do in the rest of the talk, which is the real part of the talk, that was just a historical preamble, is to try and throw some light on what might be meant by this remark at the end of Howard's footnote here about undercutting the assumptions needed to do scientific experiments. So what I want to present is a very simple model, a model with nothing to do with quantum mechanics directly, which is intended to try and introduce, well, among other things, it's intended to provide a simple kind of intuition pump, as people sometimes say, for clarifying and motivating the ideas which would have to go into a genuine retrocausal model for quantum mechanics. And at the same time, by doing that, for looking for latitude in what Howard called the core assumptions necessary to undertake scientific experiments. I got this idea of doing things in terms of toy models, partly from Rob Speckens, of course, who's done it so successfully as a way of investigating the issue as to what aspects of quantum mechanical description might be arising from epistemic characteristics. And so I felt that in a similar way, the toy model approach might be a good way of asking the question what quantum mechanic-like features might arise from retrocausality. Okay, so with that kind of motivation in mind, as I left here a year ago, I was thinking idly about simple sorts of structures in which the desired features might turn up. And this thing that I now call the Helsinki model is the result. I call it the Helsinki model partly because I actually wrote it down for the first time when I was sitting in Helsinki Airport after a flight from North America on that trip. And secondly, it seemed appropriate because, in a sense, what I was trying to do was to provide something I thought of as a kind of small and elegant alternative to Copenhagen. And that seemed to characterize Helsinki rather nicely. When I gave this talk in Sydney, at this point, one of my graduate students chimed in and said, oh, so it's got nothing to do with control by the Finnish state. Okay, so this is how the model goes. It's just really a little graph theoretic model. So there are two kinds of primitive nodes or interactions, each involving a meeting point of three edges. So there's that one with that orientation, which I call pair production, because it looks a little bit like the kind of diagram associated with pair production. And that one, which I'll call pair annihilation, which is simply the result of flipping it around the horizontal axis. There are three kinds of edges, which I just label A, B, and C. There's a rule which says that each node, whether it's a pair production or a pair annihilation node, must be either inhomogeneous in the sense that all the edges are different, or homogeneous in the sense that all the edges are the same. In connecting these primitive nodes together, you have to alternate the two different kinds, so pair production and pair annihilation must alternate. And successive homogeneous nodes are prohibited. So, for example, this one, this construction is prohibited because you see the first node reading from the bottom, the central one, is a homogeneous node, all the edges are A there, and then the one to the left is also homogeneous with all the edges of, so that violates the rule that you can't have successive homogeneous nodes. But this one is perfectly acceptable because in this case you don't have repeated homogeneous nodes. Okay. Well, the basic rules or dynamics, as we might sort of playfully call them, are obviously up-down symmetric. Or if we think of the vertical direction as being a time axis, then they're obviously time symmetric. But once we've, as it were, put a time axis into the model, then it becomes natural to think that we can control the inputs from the past and read off the outputs to the future, like this. And so in this way of drawing these diagrams, the yellow circles now represent inputs. They're the kinds of things we can control. The green squares represent outputs. You could think of them as sort of measurement dials, things you can just read off. And then the little arrows on the blue lines represent what you might think of as sort of intuitive causality or something like that. And then the wavy lines just represent the segments which we can't directly either control or read off. So I refer to those as the hidden sections. Okay, now one thing I want to stress about this is that in whatever sense we have a direction of causation in the model at this point, it's just been put in by hand, by our stipulation that we can control the things at the bottom of the model, that is in the past as we're thinking of it, and not at the top of the model. The other thing I want to point out is that you can think of, given the rules, you can think of the inputs on the left and the right as being like measurements in the sense that once you know the input and you know the output in such a case, then the rules uniquely determine the value of the third node at that, of the third edge at that point. So in this case, if you know that the input on the left is B and you know the output is C, there's nothing else the hidden edge could be at that point other than A. Okay, so now I want to do two things. I want to explain what retrocausality would amount to in a little toy model like this, given that, as I just emphasized, that the direction of causality has just been put in by hand. And then I want to show that the model actually embodies or requires retrocausality in that sense. Okay, now at this point I want to make a distinction, which I think is a very useful distinction to make, and a useful distinction to have in play in thinking about possible applications of these ideas in quantum mechanics. And it's an idea which isn't made sharply enough in the literature. And I've tried to make it myself in one or two places, but I certainly think I haven't emphasized it enough. Since the direction of causation has just been put in by hand, in this model, we could just put it in with the opposite direction. So we could adopt the convention that we could control the inputs from the top and read off outputs at the bottom. So you see, changing the convention alters the direction of intuitive causality. But obviously that's not a particularly interesting possibility. The interesting possibility, and the one I want to call retrocausation as opposed to reverse causation, is the case in which ordinary interventions from the past can make a difference prior to the intervention. That is, if the choice of the two measurement settings, B and C on the left and right here, can affect what we can call the hidden state, and what I'll write with the angle brackets in this case. Here's the hidden state, which I'm writing like this. And we have retrocausality if we can show that the choice of the input here or over here on the right affects that hidden state. And what I want to show you is that in this model, with these simple rules, that's got to be the case. Now, I could have drawn this diagram in a way which would make it kind of more intuitively forceful that it is retrocausality by shortening the line between, say, the B on the left and the node that it leads into to make it clear that the choice of that input doesn't have to be made until long after there's a fact of the matter as to what the edge is on the hidden state. I always have trouble seeing these spots myself, so I could have shortened that line here to make it clear or sort of convey the idea that the choice of the input here doesn't have to be made until long after there's a fact of the matter as to what's on that edge. So if you like, just imagine those input edges as being much shorter than they actually appear in this diagram. Okay, now to show that this model involves retrocausality, what we need to do first is to just enumerate all the admissible configurations for this kind of model. And I'll do this ignoring some obvious kinds of symmetries. So I'll just consider cases in which the central input is A and list all the options for that case. Okay, so if the central input is A, then we can just run through the possibilities for what the other two inputs can be. And I'll write it in this form, so the notation AAA for the setting just means reading left to right, so the inputs are A, A, and A. And in this particular case, the hidden state is BC, meaning B on the left and C on the right. And so that's one of the possibilities in the case in which all three of the inputs are A, and the other one is that one. So there are just two possibilities in this case. And that, of course, that's just a mirror image of the other one. Okay, second possibility is when we have the same input in the center and on the left, and we have a different input on the right. And in this case, again, there are just those two possibilities. In this case, they're not a mirror image of each other because we haven't reversed the A and the B on the left and right. Third possibility is that the inputs on left and right are both different from the center input, but they're the same as each other. So we can just consider the case where it's a B, so we have this BAB setting. And in this case, there are three possible hidden states. You can have AA like this, you can have BC like this, or you can have CB like this. And then the last possibility we need to consider is the case in which the left and right inputs are both different from the center inputs, and they're also different from each other. So BAC is a representative of that kind of case. And in this case, again, there are three possibilities, the AA, the CB, and the BC, the hidden state. Okay, so we can summarize all of those results on this little table. There's up to symmetry, there's really only four possible choices of measurement settings, four possible choices of inputs that we need to consider, and there are three possible hidden states. And the interesting fact, the fact on which the retrocausality depends, is that in the case of the first two combinations of inputs, the AAA and the AAB, the first kind of hidden state, the AA hidden state, is impossible. So the inputs AAA and AAB exclude the hidden state AA. Okay, so why does that imply retrocausality? Well, consider this case. This is an acceptable case. This is a case in which we have inputs B on the left and right, and in which the hidden state is actually AA. What we know is that if either of the inputs on the left or right had been an A, like this, then the hidden state couldn't have been AA. So once we change one of the inputs to an A, we have to change the hidden state as well. And there are two possibilities as to what it can be. The hidden state can be either a BC, in which case the output reading from left to right is BB, or it can be CB, in which the output reading from left to right is AC, but it can't be, the hidden state can't be AA. Okay, so this is a crucial step, so I just make sure everyone's clear on it. Okay, so the idea is that in a case in which the situation is actually that, you know that if you had made a different choice, say on the right, the hidden state would have been different. Yeah, I'll come to that. I'll come to that, good. So the hidden state is depending retrocausally, given the understanding of causality that we have in this simple model, depending retrocausally on the fact that neither observer chose to input an A rather than a B. And it's also worth noting, although I won't say very much about this, but I think it's an interesting feature of the model too, that the output on the left also depends on the measurement setting on the right, and vice versa in this kind of case. And so we have something that looks a little bit like a kind of non-locality. Okay, so here's a simple model in which under a very intuitive kind of interpretation, we already get something like retrocausality, and we already get something which can be clearly distinguished from the less interesting possibility that I called reverse causality. So what can we do with it next? Well, the obvious thought at this point, which is the one which Roddy has already had, is the whole model consistent, or can it be made inconsistent by making the constructions bigger in some way? So one question here is whether by putting these things together into larger constructions, there's some choice of inputs which allows no consistent assignments of hidden states and outputs. And when I wrote this talk, I thought the answer to that was no, but I wasn't quite sure. But now I can't edit the talk on this little machine, but now I would say the answer is definitely no. And it turns out there's actually a very simple proof. I mean, if there are inconsistent structures of this kind, then there's one of minimum length. But if you took one of minimum length, you could make a shorter one by taking off the first level and just taking its outputs, feeding them in as inputs to the next level yourself. And so that shows that there aren't any inconsistent ones. Okay, but there's another way in which you could get inconsistencies. If you were sort of thinking of this, at least if you're thinking of this as a model for something you might have in the real world. And this turns on the fact, which has been noted in the context of EPR, Bell experiments, that in those experiments it's possible to arrange things so that the output of the experiment on one side controls the choice of measurement settings on the other side. You simply got to delay the choice of measurement settings on one side until you've already got the result by an ordinary classical channel from the other side. And of course, you could think about what happens in this little model when you allow that sort of possibility. Yossi Berkowitz is, I can't see where Yossi is, but he's one person who's discussed the issues arising from the possibility that there might be causal loops in retrocausal models in quantum mechanics because of precisely this kind of possibility. So what we want to consider is the case in which, say, the output on the left can control the input on the right. Now, I know that as I've drawn the diagram here, it looks as if that red arrow is itself representing a retrocausal influence, but that's just inessential. It's just because I haven't been clever enough to draw the diagram in such a way that the right-hand side stretches out further into the future so that arrow could point upwards rather than downwards. So think of that arrow as just representing an ordinary, unproblematic, classical causal channel with a normal sort of causal direction past to future. So what we want to investigate is whether putting constraints on the model, and this particular case is supposed to represent the constraint which says, if you get a B on the left, then you input a C on the right. If you get a C on the left, then you input a B on the right. Now in this particular case, there's no inconsistency because there's two possible consistent assignments of the hidden state, both of which lead to the same output on the right. So, as it were, putting this constraint on the model is not going to shut it down. it may restrict its options, but it's not going to lead to any kind of paradox. But there might be other cases of this kind in which you get, in which there's no consistent solution. Here's a slightly more general case. So this is the case. We're still looking at the case in which we have the same input in the center and on the left. And we're now looking at the three possible ways in which a left output of B can fix a right input. And as that, as the assignments there show, all three of those ways of tying a left input, sorry, the right input to the left output B all lead to, all allow consistent assignments. And what that shows is that in the case in which the central input and the left input are the same, there's no way of imposing this kind of restriction, which will lead to inconsistency in the sense of not leaving the system any consistent assignments. Because whatever the rule is for assigning the right input based on the left output, in the case in which the left output is B, all possible versions of the rule lead to a consistent assignment. OK, so that's the case in which the initial and the left inputs are the same. In that case, we can't get to an inconsistency. So the only other case we need to consider is the case in which the left inputs and the central input are different. And in this case, too, there's one left output such that no matter what the rule is connecting that to the right input, there's no inconsistency. So again, in this case, a constraint of this kind can't it can't lead to the situation in which there's no consistent assignment for the system as a whole. Okay, but these kinds of additional constraints are non-trivial. So this is a case in which having the constraint in place does exclude a hidden state which would otherwise be possible. See, if we didn't have a rule in place which says if we get a C on the left, then we have to have an A on the right, then we could have a B on the right. And in that case, you could have a hidden state of AA. But with this rule in place, that's not possible. So the model is rich enough to show how this kind of additional constraint can impose, this kind of causal loop can impose additional constraints without leading to inconsistency. OK, well, that's basically all I have. I'm just going to finish by mentioning some things it would be nice to do next with this kind of model, which I haven't tried to do myself at this point. It would be nice to add some probabilities to it and to try to show that in virtue of the feature of a model which I've been interpreting as retrocausality, those probabilities have some of the characteristics of quantum amplitudes. For example, to show that the probabilities of the results of measurements can't generally be regarded as probabilities of pre-existing states if those states are regarded as having to be independent of the choice of the future inputs or measurement settings. And if that could be done, then I think it would be possible to develop an analogy between the information you have in this little model if you don't know the future inputs and the standard quantum mechanical wave function. And if you could do that, then I think you could connect this kind of model, or perhaps some descendant of it, to the kind of thing that Rob is doing in his epistemic toy models. But as I say, that's just a program for some things I'd like to be able to do, and not a list of things that I know how to do. Another thing, actually, which isn't on this list, it would be to try and connect this to some of the kind of real-life retrocausal models that people have been proposing and it's heartening for me to see that there are several of these at this meeting. I mean, in the poster sessions, I know that Nathan Argerman has one, which I knew about before, and Ken Wharton has one, and then there's another one. I apologize to the person concerned, but I just met him yesterday, and his name escapes me. But there's at least three posters out there describing approaches, approaches to real quantum mechanics, but which all involve these kinds of retrocausal ideas. Okay, that's it.
It strikes me that this model is really just, we can either take Arana, Weidman, two-state model, or decoherence functional, etc., with some additional philosophical baggage about using words like causation, etc., piled on top of it. Is there anything more to it than that?
Well, it depends whether the baggage that you're trying to pile on top of it would be would amount to giving up the assumption in the derivation of the Bell inequalities, the assumption that the hidden variables don't depend on future measurement settings. If your baggage does involve giving up that assumption, then it's going to be the case that that assumption is going to look rather problematic if it can be, as it were, defeated by standard baggage. So that's the reason, I think, for thinking that the kind of things you're thinking of aren't strong enough to count as retrocausality. I mean, I think the case of the Aronoff-Weidman kind of approach, I mean, I think this is already clear in some of Leb's remarks in his talk the other day. The issue as to whether it's a retrocausal model is a controversial one, and based on what Leb's told me, I think that Aronoff thinks of it more in a retrocausal way than Leb himself does. I mean, when I've talked to Leb about it, both here and in other places, my impression is, I mean, Leb can speak for himself, obviously, but my impression is that in a sense, he's using the many worlds framework as a way of avoiding interpreting it retrocausally, whereas what I'd want to recommend is forget about many worlds, interpret it retrocausally, and then use the advantages the advantages that the hidden variable approach has as a way of avoiding having to go down the many worlds path.
I was actually wondering how a retrocausal model of this sort differs in the sense of retrocausation that it displays to a model of a classical theory with closed time-like curves. Okay, in both. The difference I can see is related to something, the distinction Howard made, is that you're sort of, I think, by stipulation regarding the parameter settings as freely chosen. But if you didn't, if you incorporated those into a deterministic model of the entire, deterministic retrocausal model of the entire thing, it strikes me that you would get something like a classical, you might get something, depending on how you fleshed it out, just like a classical theory with closed time-like curves, in which there was a constraint on space-like data. So in other words, you get non-local correlations without any problematic kinds of correlation. So,
okay, but so I think you noted there's a sense in which in going that way, you'd be throwing away the idea that you had a choice as to what things you wanted to wiggle. I mean, the way I want to do retrocausality, I want to hang on to that intuition. I mean, I think the direction of causation insofar as there is one kind of comes from us in the sense that it's based on our intuitions about what we can wiggle and what else wiggles. But one of the things I want to stress is that view that there's an important sense in which it comes from us is compatible with there being a real question as to whether the correlational structure of the world is such as to permit this kind of case, where you can wiggle things at two points in such a way that something in between changes. I think that's the interesting case for quantum mechanics, and that's the kind of case that I was trying to use this model to illustrate. Now, it's not incompatible with thinking about what you get in closed time-like curves and so on. Well, it's not sort of logically incompatible, but it is sort of motivationally incompatible in that sort of throwing away the idea of free choice, whereas this is emphasizing it for pointing out that you can have free choice in these kinds of circumstances, but also have this feature of rhetoric as well.
I would like to make a comment, which is perhaps strengthening what you were saying. The free parameters in this Bell game are the measurement settings, and the fact that they are free is sometimes confused with retrocausality, which is something that has a direction in time. So we shouldn't. The fact that they are free is something that they're input parameters. Now, the output parameters, the results of the measurements, have a different character, and we have to distinguish models in which that also is allowed as input, like the two-state models, where you post-select, you know which post-selection you've done, and that influences things in between. From toy models, such as I think what you're doing with the Helsinki model, and what I'm doing with my description of the model, which is only the input parameters are allowed to influence retrocausally. The output parameters are output. They're not allowed to influence anything.
Yeah, good. No, I agree absolutely with that. And I think another potential advantage of doing things in this very simple way in terms of these toy models is that it enables you to make that distinction clearly. So what you're putting right up front is the idea that the things that the sense in which you have causation is driven by the kind of things you can control as an experimenter, namely the inputs. And so you want to distinguish questions of dependencies associated with those from questions of dependencies associated with things like measurement outcomes.
So I'm wondering if it's possible to extend this in the sense that, because it seems to me a more accurate picture of the way we are in the world is that there are lots of inputs and outputs sort of deep in the mist of history, not just at the beginning and at the end.
There was something I missed in the middle of that sentence.
So, it seems like the real situation we're in is that there's lots of inputs and outputs sort of deep in the middle of history, not just at the beginning and at the end. I wonder if your model could accommodate that.
I think so, in the sense that I think that the sort of no inconsistency proof that I have will show that allowing for that possibility in an explicit way isn't going to create any difficulties.
It looks like all the outputs, all the inputs are at the beginning, so to speak, and all the outputs are at the end, and they're on the edge of...
Well, yeah, it would be interesting to investigate kind of more complicated constructions in which... it's already not true, even in these very simple cases, it's not already not true think of the case I was considering in the last section there, is where you put in the what I would call the classical causal link from the left to the right. That's already a case in which the output on the left is occurring before the input on the right. And so you've already got some of the kind of mixing up of the ordering of outputs and inputs that you're talking about. I agree. It's an interesting issue as to whether more complicated ways of doing that could create difficulties. I suspect the answer is no, and I suspect that the simple kind of no inconsistency proof that I've got will work for that too. But I'm not certain about that.
And just a comment. Indeed, you correctly interpret my approach that I go to many worlds to avoid retrocausation of two-state vector formalism. And just a technical question about this model, the Helsinki model. Maybe I didn't understood exactly, but it looks like it's retrocausal relative to these hidden variables only, because if it's only for hidden variables, well, why should we care if causal or retrocausal?
We should care because, I mean, after all, go back to the beginning. Go back to the view that Bell has shown that Einstein was wrong about quantum mechanics. I mean, what he's taken to have shown Einstein to be wrong about was about the possibility of regarding quantum mechanics as incomplete, of taking the view that there is a some deeper level than quantum mechanics. Whereas if you can get to the deeper level by emitting retrocausality, then, and as it were, avoid that implication of Bell's theorem in that way, then the field is much more open than it was before, because Einstein's position is still on the agenda in the retrocausal form. And on the agenda with all the kind of attractions it has of you know, having an easier time with the measurement problem because it doesn't have to treat collapse as a physical process, all of those kinds of things.
Just one sentence, I think it's pity that Einstein didn't know about many word interpretation, because I think it exactly does what he wanted to do.
Okay. Oh, well, that's obviously a much bigger issue, Ludwig. I'm sure we'll have a chance to discuss.
I'm going to take a question from Lee Smolin and then from Julian.
No, I didn't know about that at all, so thank you for that. Okay, so would another way to put that question be as the question as to why the retrocausal effects are so small and hard to see? Okay, but why is that sort of, as it were, distinctively a problem for a retrocausal view? No, I certainly don't have anything to say about that.
First, this is a slightly mischievous remark. I feel that you're sort of subliminally trying to attune us to retrocausality with your PowerPoint, where you can see in ghostly letters what's coming before it's highlighted. But I was absolutely fascinated by your story about Einstein and Ehrenfest trying to see Tetroda, because of course, and I like your views possibly on what Einstein might have thought about retrocausality if you said it, in view of his famous debate, I think it was in 1909 with Ritz, about the interpretation of the apparent retardation in electrodynamics. And as I recall, Ritz said, retardation is a fundamental law of nature. And Einstein said, no, it's just a byproduct of the second law of thermodynamics.
Exactly, exactly.
So I wonder whether you might like to just comment on that, Hugh.
Well, I don't feel that I can sort of comment in any expert way, but for the very reason you've mentioned, I mean, I've had the thought in the past that one would have expected Einstein to be kind of congenial, to find these sorts of ideas congenial in a way which, as you say, someone like Ritz, who thinks that there's something fundamentally asymmetric in the causal structure of the world, would not.
Okay.
A footnote to that. I mean, one of the interesting issues that I often come back to is why Bell himself didn't make more of these issues. And it's sort of well known that he thought that they led in the direction of fatalism. I think that's partly because he didn't properly distinguish the kind of true retrocausal case from what's sometimes called the superdeterministic case, where you have some new factor in the past which is controlling both your choice of measurement setting and the hidden variables. But I think it's also, I think there's some reason to think that it's also something more basic in Bell's own outlook. I mean, I've heard it said that the Bell himself was attracted towards a kind of a less block kind of picture of time and a more sort of dynamic picture. And it may be that something of that kind, as it were, acted as something of a block, as one might say, to his own thinking in this direction. But I don't think Einstein would have had that block.
Okay, so we have to move on. So let's thank Hugh again for a fascinating talk. So the next talk in this morning's session will be by Samson Abramsky from